This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Welcome to the 29th annual Writers Symposium by the Sea at Point Loma Nazarene University. I'm Dean Nelson. I'm the journalism faculty at the university. And we have two very distinguished writers with us tonight. Nick Hornby is an award-winning author and screenwriter. His books include Fever Pitch, High Fidelity, About a Boy, Dickens and Prince, and several others. His movies include An Education, Brooklyn, as well as those adapted from his books. He also writes columns about books, music, soccer, pop culture, many other things. Susan Orlean is also an award-winning author whose books include The Orchid Thief, The Library Book, Rin Tin Tin, On Animals, and several collections of her stories from her magazine work with The New Yorker, Outside, Vogue, Rolling Stone, Esquire, and others. She's working on adapting her book, The Library Book, for a series with Paramount TV. Nick Hornby, Susan Orlean, welcome to the Writers Symposium by the Sea.
Thank you.
Besides the fact that it's just cool that you're here, I think it's even cooler that the two of you have never actually been in the same place until today. You've been playing Words with Friends, you've been working on a film project together, but the Writers' Symposium brought you into the same house. Is that accurate?
That's pretty accurate.
How's that going so far?
I have mixed feelings.
Me too.
I'm saying nothing at all.
Yeah, it's gonna be one of those nights.
It's funny though, in the world we live in now, I have a lot of people who I consider friends who I've never met. I think that's part of what's been a huge change since social media came into our lives, that I refer to people as friends. And I think, you know, I actually don't even know where they live or what their real name is.
Or whether they're wearing pants when you talk to them on the...
Right. Or if it's, like, not a dog. I mean, that's the famous New Yorker cartoon on the internet, No One Knows You're a Dog.
Right. That's a good cartoon. So this doesn't feel weird being in the same space?
Oh, super weird. In fact, I'm about to leave.
It was weird seeing each other, what was it, this morning? Just this morning, for the first time. And you recognized me and came over and said hello. And it was
actually,
odd.
Honestly, I was feeling shy and a little nervous. And I think particularly, I mean, we did meet once. Nick remembers, I don't.
It's always the way.
You and women, right there, isn't it, Nick? Yeah.
For one quick second at a New Yorker party, and over the years, we know people in common, mm-hmm. and I'm a great fan of his, and you know, we've had this sort of occasional overlapping in the world. But I live in LA. He lives in England. Seemed like the paths would never cross. And then we began playing Words with Friends, although you didn't think it was really me. First, you rejected me. And I was like, whoa, what a snob. I thought, I've never been rejected on Words with Friends.
That is kind of harsh.
Wow.
We were talking about this. It's the same thing. We don't know if someone's a dog or whether they're wearing trousers.
There it is.
We've both been challenged by Paul Schrader, the director. And the first thing you think is, no way is the director, Paul Schrader, going to be challenging me on Words with Friends.
Right. You think it's some 12-year-old girl in Oklahoma who thinks it's funny.
If a 12-year-old in Oklahoma made a Paul Schrader joke, I'd be quite impressed.
True. I would like to meet that. Yeah. But that's, I think our particular relationship is funny because we had that connection and then lo and behold, had this film project happen. And I thought, all right, one of these days we're gonna have to meet.
Yeah.
I mean, this is really, this is, and here we are.
Yeah, yeah, you're welcome. So we're gonna get to that film project in just a minute, but let me just ask a couple of you just individual questions about your writing. Nick, many of your books deal with themes of masculinity, marriage, marital disillusionment, moral and emotional confusion, and difficult relationships. After reading almost all of your novels, I have one question for you. Is anyone in England happily married?
I think with all of these things, you think, well, if they are, and they've got a successful job, what is there to write about?
Well, there you go.
And especially if some thing of, or some part of what you do is attempting to be funny. I don't want to read a novel about a CEO who has a beautiful wife that he loves and they've been married for 30 years and there's no problems with their kids. That's like not even a paragraph. So you're always writing about people at their point of crisis. The whole thing about fiction is you're choosing a defining moment in a character's life, which is actually one reason why I don't really like novels where it's the same detective every time. You think, really? This isn't as exciting as the thing you did 4 years ago, you know? And in, I guess, whatever you call my kind of fiction, but non-genre fiction, there isn't anything else to say about those people other than that they lived this moment of crisis in the pages of my novel. But no, you're right, no one's happily married in England either.
That was kind of a roundabout way to get to the
answer. Yeah, it's the weather.
But no, I mean, a fundamental truth about really any kind of story is that only trouble is interesting.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. Susan, many of your books and articles deal with obsession. The guy in The Orchid Thief, the boy whose dog becomes Rin Tin Tin, and then it seems you get caught up in that obsession as the writer. So I want to know, why is obsession so interesting to you?
I think actually it's somewhat similar to what Nick just said. Obsession is the sort of distillation, the intensification of a personality, of desire. I mean, I think we're all dealing all the time with what do we want, what do we strive for, what are we aspiring to? And obsession is taking that very natural human emotion and intensifying it and seeing it in the extreme. And I think sometimes what I find most interesting within an obsession is how normal and ordinary you are within the boundaries of the obsession. I wrote a story some years ago about taxidermists, and these were people who were so obsessed with taxidermy that when we went out to dinner and we had baby back ribs, they then reassembled the ribs. And, but what was funny is within this super niche obsession, there was such, it was so familiar. It was, I've run out of black dye for the bear that I'm stuffing. And I need a nail file for the coyote that I've just finished mounting. It's, and so I love that tension between the way ordinary life always keeps chugging along, even when you're in this very extreme, very dramatic context.
Well,
sorry, can I say,
yeah, please?
It's like if people don't have an obsession, I worry about them.
Really?
Yeah, it's like, you're basically saying, what's your thing? And if someone says, well, nothing really, work,
well,
my
and
kids,
I think
I'm not interested.
And actually, I think that that's genuinely terrifying. And I think that's where you get, I mean, there's a lot of theorizing about what's going on in society and how people are no longer strongly attached to something. And so many of us work on our own and we don't belong to a bowling league and a church group and so on and so forth. And there's this sense of simply having a persona that's just scattered as mm-hmm. opposed to, I think obsession is very comforting. In The Orchid Thief, this is where it really struck me that life is chaos. Life can feel very discordant and confusing. But if you have an obsession, you are always able to shrink it down because you're looking for that cast iron skillet that you collect. And, or you're looking for the Hummel figurine, or you're just practicing your ukulele so you can perform at a picnic. It takes the chaos of life and gives it shape.
And that's what you love to write about.
I love it, and I also feel like it's the way to understand people is
absolutely.
Through how do they organize the world? How does the world make sense to them? What's the way they have shaped the otherwise rather shapeless experience of being alive?
I think the other thing to say about obsessives is that everything we know is as a result of somebody's obsession.
Right. Like
Copernicus wasn't an obsessive. Of course he was an obsessive. And Einstein and everybody, they were obsessives. And we owe them a lot that they were prepared to put aside the rest of life and get right into it.
And I think it's interesting when you watch Oppenheimer, you also realize that there's a cost. That it doesn't necessarily always work to integrate an obsession with having an ordinary life, that the further you go into obsession, the more narcissistic you become and the harder it is for you to... Now, I would also say there are a lot of people who are obsessed with their kids or their family or their community and...
Or themselves.
And I mean, maybe obsessed is the wrong word, but that's their way of making sense of the world.
Sure.
And I think that's very common. Or obsessed with their job or obsessed with making money.
So you have this great line in Orchid Thief where you said, I want to know what it feels like to care about something passionately. Strong feelings always make me skeptical at first. And then you pursue this in your stories. I just think it's a great way to get at the human condition, the human being, how we fit in the world, just as you're saying.
And I think Susan and I would both agree that with an obsession, you're never very far away from a joke either.
Right.
I mean, it's pretty
exactly.
funny, some of it.
This is...
Oh, my God, yes.
Actually, I think that's true of both of you. It does seem, when you read each of your work, that you are slightly amused by what you're writing about. Is that accurate?
Totally. Absolutely, totally. I mean, people are funny. We're funny. We're weird, screwy things. And there's nothing funnier than watching people bumbling, including me, bumbling through life. And I think as a writer, you are a professional skeptic and a professional, I'm not a joiner, I'm an observer. Or you become a writer because you're a skeptic. But I feel like I can appreciate both the satisfaction it gives you to be absorbed in obsession and at the same time can find it pretty amusing.
Yeah. And you always seem like everything's on the cusp of being a punchline.
Never quite getting there, you mean.
No, you
failure to launch.
Yeah, that's my obsession, is to get to a punchline.
Get to the punchline. There it is. So actually, Nick, you in addition to your fiction, you write about books and music, but you say you're not a critic, you're a consumer. Mm. What's the difference?
Well, this started to become clear to me when I began writing my Believer column, quite a long time ago now. But it was my idea that I wasn't paid to write about an individual book, that I just wrote about what I'd read that month and why, and what books I'd bought and what books I hadn't read. And that seemed to me to be a kind of honest reflection of how we consume culture. Some people will perhaps remember that some months I didn't read anything at all, but I still wrote 2,000 words about not having read it.
Exactly. Because you were too busy watching Arsenal.
It was usually the World Cup. The World Cup is a reading disaster zone. But I get to write about the World Cup instead. I think there's a lot more to say about books and music than whether it's any good or not. And I think the older you get, you realize that you don't know whether it's any good or not anyway. If a book reaches enough people, it will be somebody's favorite book of all time. And it doesn't matter what that book is, it will be someone's favorite book of all time. And what are you going to say if that is what you judge to be a mediocre work by that particular writer, or a terrible book by somebody who's only written one? It's a judgment I'm not prepared to make anymore. I don't want to argue with anyone about what they love, and I guess that's why I'm a consumer, not a critic.
I think one of the most interesting things about that Believer column that you did was the list at the beginning of each. These are the books that I bought and did not read. These are the books that I read. And I just thought, oh man, I do that all the time. I've got lots of books at home that I haven't read yet. And you tapped into something.
Yeah, I'm very interested in the process of that because, first of all, usually about 6 weeks later, I look at a couple of them, I think, what the hell was I thinking? Who was the person who walked into a bookstore and thought, oh yeah, I want to know about that? Or usually nonfiction. Anyway, it goes on the bedside table and the pile gets quite big. And then after a little while, you think, that bottom six, they're not going to get read.
They're gone, yeah.
Well, they go on the shelves then. So you go from bedside table to shelves.
So it looked like you read it.
So it sort of looks like you read them. But yeah. And I always want to know what the moment is where it becomes a bedside table book to a shelf book. I don't know what that decision is. You know, there was a time when if you were in a Chinese restaurant and ordered duck with pancakes, that the Chinese waiter would always say, so you put the oyster sauce on the pancake and then you put the cucumber and the spring onion and you put the duck and then you roll it up and you go, oh, thanks very much. And then one day they stopped doing it. The last time I've been told that in a Chinese restaurant, I don't know, but they decided that everyone in the world knew that how to do a duck pancake. And there must have been some collective decision that we are not explaining to these people anymore. And I would like to know when that happened. And it's the same thing with the bedside table to the shelf. How does this happen? I didn't even notice it happening.
That was amazing. Susan, when you started out in journalism, you never were interested in like hard news, breaking news, right? It was always features for you. It was always the human interest thing. Even as I thought we all started with hard news. You didn't?
I didn't, because I realized early on that I simply didn't care about knowing things first.
Hmm.
That never compelled me. I went to the University of Michigan. They had a great newspaper that, you know, people were breaking news. It was a daily newspaper and very professionally done. And I would see my friends who worked there, and they were really motivated by this desire to know things first and let people know about what they learned first. And I guess it was a lucky thing for me that I realized early on that that just did not animate me. I don't know if I could have been good at it or not good at it. I have no idea. I just knew that I didn't have that passion to find out. And I've done some investigative reporting. I've certainly done stories that have an element of news, but I knew early on that that wasn't the way I looked at the world.
Sure. And you've continued that, because the way you look at the world is, I want to understand this human being. I want to understand this condition. I want to understand this passion that people, or I want to understand this place. Those are things you're so, so skilled at. So let's talk about early influences. Nick, what was it about Ann Tyler's writing that got your attention?
Well, after university, I mean, I went to Cambridge in England, and it pretty much killed me in terms of alienated me from literature, from writing, from everything. And I spent...
That's what a college education does, right?
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
I spent 3 years like avoiding my tutors because I hadn't done any work. A lot of time going to secondhand record shops and actually talking about and playing football. So when I look back on it, it's probably my first two books were the result of my Cambridge education, but not perhaps in the way that Cambridge had hoped. And then afterwards, I knew I wanted to write, but I couldn't see how to do the kind of third-person English prose where there's a distant and an omniscient narrator, and I thought I couldn't do it, and I tried writing screenplays instead. I didn't know what form they were supposed to take. I didn't know anyone in the film industry, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, one day, I was in a bookshop looking for something to read, still feeling a bit alienated post-university from reading, and I picked up Dinner at the Homesick Restaurant, and it had a voice, first of all, that I recognized as a voice, which, again, I hadn't been reading very much of in my classical education or the traditional education. And what we were talking about earlier on, she was speaking. She spoke to me, and I thought, whoa, you can do that? And then you look at the back of the book, and it says, you know, greatest living novelist and winner of the Pulitzer Prize, and you think, well, not only can you do it, but you can win prizes doing it just through talking to people. And then you look at the bestseller list in the New York Times. She's like number one. You think, you sell books as well.
Just sign me up.
But it was like a jolt of electricity, the realization that if you use your speaking voice and as much elegance and wit and soul as you can while doing it, that amounts to something that means something to people.
And yet, Charles Dickens is still your guy.
I never thought I could write a Charles Dickens novel. And that was the difference, that with Ann Tyler, it wasn't like I thought I could ever be as good as Ann Tyler, but I thought that's something I can pitch for. I can pitch for that. That is a runway that I can get on the beginning of. And we were talking a bit about influence early on, and it felt to me like everything I consumed just came out as a direct copy. But Ann Tyler read High Fidelity, and she knew that I'd talked about her work a lot, and she read it and wrote me a letter about it. and said, I have no idea what it has to do with my work, but I really love it. And I thought, well, that's maybe how influence should be. You don't know how much you had to do with it.
Interesting. And Susan, one of the things that you've written about since the early days has been animals. I believe when you were a child, I don't know how old, you wrote a book about a nearsighted pigeon. Is that correct?
It was a huge bestseller in my house. And
you made them pay for it?
Yeah, of course, of course. I wrote a little book when, the family legend has it that I was five. It was called Herbert the Nearsighted Pigeon. It's actually not a bad little story. I found it recently, which was kind of exciting. I think it was about a pigeon who was ignoring his friends and they were ignoring him, and there was a lot of tragedy involved there.
And then
he meets an owl who's wearing glasses, and the owl says, you know, you probably need glasses.
And
the pigeon is like, oh my God, I'm nearsighted, and he gets glasses. And then he can recognize his friends. And so it ends quite happily.
Yeah, yeah.
I've done some research into this. I'm doing a profile of Susan for the New Yorker. And she was,
oh my God,
she was 24 when she wrote that.
Right. Actually, it came out last year. And I dare you to laugh at that. I'm very proud of it. But... But yes, I've always written about animals, and
I think you even wrote about horses. You wrote so many stories about horses, thinking that if you wrote about them often enough, they would appear.
Yes, I felt like it was, you know, that book, The Wish, where you manifest things, like you manifest a boyfriend. I wanted to manifest a horse. Note to self, it didn't work. But... I was one of these kids who just loved animals. I loved horseback riding. I loved cats. I loved dogs. And I think I guess my attraction to them as story material is that whatever we think is mysterious about human existence is even more mysterious about animal existence. But in addition, and I rarely write about animals in a vacuum. It really is always about how the human-animal interface works, whether it's a dog, whether it's a whale. I mean, these stories end up being portals into something really, that's really about people. And there are also just marvelously diverse and interesting in every way, but it tends to be a way into writing about people.
Sure. So let's keep talking about your respective strengths. Nick, I think one of your strengths as a writer is dialogue, which makes sense since you do so many screenplays. It is so precise. And it reveals the character. You know, when you think about how does a character get revealed in a fiction work, it's usually appearance, how they move, how they interact with the setting, how they speak. Almost all of your character revelation is in how they speak, and then how they think about what they've just said in your stories. I wish I could talk the way your characters talk, because they're so funny and they're so deep. So are you always listening and eavesdropping and hearing stuff that you're thinking, oh, that could totally work in a dialogue? Or is this just coming out of you?
I am really nosy. If I've got headphones on the top of a bus, and I can see there's something going on between two people, then I'll turn the music off and keep the headphones in so it looks like I'm not listening. And there's nothing that goes directly into a movie or a book, but the rhythm of it and also the specificity of what people might argue about. They never argue. It's never like, you don't love me, yes, I do love you. You know, it's always, there's some warp and weft and weird detail in there that you think, I must remember that, that not that particular detail, but you can replace it with something else and it will sound pretty good. But I don't know, people have been nice about my dialogue, and all I can say is it's so easy for me that it's not a talent I value. That the stuff that's harder for me, that I think, oh, you know, I did that, I got through it. But the dialogue, I don't have to think twice. I can write it very quickly. And really, the problem is being disciplined about it. You can write too much, and you think, actually, they're just talking, and maybe it sounds good, and maybe it's realistic, but it's not getting me anywhere. It's taking me further away, in fact. So then I've got to go back and start cutting and pruning.
But you do it from so many different points of view. I just started to make a list earlier. You capture voices of young men in your books, of a female doctor, of a woman who falls for the neighborhood butcher, a 16-year-old boy who just got his girlfriend pregnant. They don't all sound the same. You're doing this from all these different points of view, and I just marvel at your ability to do it.
Well, thank you, but you know, I've got kids, I've got sisters, I've got wives, I've got friends' kids. I mean,
wives, that was plural, wives?
I've had wives, plural, yeah, yes. Yeah.
Okay, just clarify.
I've never more than one at a time, though.
Appreciate that.
No, you think if you listen to them, then they say different things and they sound different, and they come from different classes, and yeah.
And Susan, one of your strengths is, I think, description. So here are just a few of my favorites. These are quotes. Rows of identical houses that from a distance look like angry welts. Or walking through the Florida swamp is like walking through a car wash. Or hair as shiny as an otter's. Or a woman releases your hand gently as if she were putting a fish back in the water. Her voice is possibly alto with a little tremor that snags on a syllable now and then. These are all lines from your books. She has a voice that could compete volume-wise with an accordion solo.
Can I ask you, Susan, how many of those you remember?
I'm terrified. I'm hearing them and they sound like, oh, those are cool. I wonder who wrote those.
This is what we were saying earlier on.
Is that weird?
No, but when I was saying that I pick, you know, if someone's asked me to read from an old book or something, and I pick it up and I read it, I think, whoa,
yeah,
who wrote this?
Well done.
I can't do that anymore. But I was wondering if any of the lines rang a bell, because usually things don't with me.
Yeah, I mean, I won't deny that I wrote them.
They had your name. Okay, I have one more though. This is my personal favorite. This is your story about, I think it was a dieting circle that you wrote about. Every few minutes or so, he would smooth his polo shirt down over his torso and then stare in wonderment at the change in topography that took place around his waist. It wasn't quite alpine, but there was at least evidence of continental drift. That's just awesome. So
that I actually remember.
Okay. So here's my question. How hard do you work at this? Because this isn't coming in first drafts.
No, and I think the challenge for me is I'm very mindful of not doing too much description, but if I'm gonna do it, it's gotta matter. It has to really stick the landing or there's no point. And to make a description that's really fresh and really visual, that, I mean, it's hard.
I know, that's why I'm marveling at what you do.
I do spend a lot of time, and I feel like I have to budget every word and make it really matter. I also have a feeling, I feel like an image has to be logical as well as vivid, and it's kind of hard to explain what I mean, but it has to sort of make sense. Or maybe it's that I feel the reader has to instantly get it. They have to instantly be able to see what I'm saying.
Well, yeah, let me give you another example. The fire at the library, it glowered angrily, feeding itself book after book, a monster snacking on chips. That was amazing.
And I will say that passage, which I spent a huge amount of time, and this was describing the fire at the Los Angeles Library, in which 400,000 books burned up, and the fire burned for 7 hours. And I thought, you know, I've really got to describe this. I mean, this is really important. This is a sort of hinge point in the book, is this fire. I spent a huge amount of time. I had the resources of the fire department kept a log of really like every 5 minutes they log which hoses they're using, which firefighters are in the building. It was very technical. But it also, and then I interviewed a lot of firefighters, so I knew from them how the fire moved through the building. And I was immediately struck by this idea that this was an animate thing. It was like an animal that was gobbling things up. And in a chemical way, that's actually true. I mean, fire wants to stay alive and it keeps burning. And it, when a fire is going through a library, it goes through section by section. So it's eating all of the fiction and then all of the cookbooks and then all of the patent records. And I began really being able to visualize this beast. And it was so clever, it kept avoiding the firefighters. So I got very immersed in it, and I was lucky because I had all this reporting that was not descriptive, but helped me be able to picture what was going on. And then I wrote that literally word by word, just making sure each word was the right word.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really, really proud of it when I was done, because it was hard.
It's amazing.
Can I ask, Susan, maybe tell the audience, because I think this is so great, such a great detail, why we all missed this fire first time round?
Well, this was one of these, you know, gifts from fate, which was, you know, I heard about the fire, the largest library fire in American history, and I thought how it took place in 1986. I thought, how could it be that I never heard of this? Mm. And that it had never come up in conversation. I just couldn't understand it. And I was living in New York at the time of the fire. I thought, well, let me go back and look at the New York Times from that day and try to understand what could have been so important that they didn't write about this fire. So I go to the archives of the New York Times for that date in 1986, and the headline, huge banner headline, meltdown at Chernobyl nuclear plant.
It's so amazing.
I mean, it was actually, you know, I hate to say Chernobyl was a good thing, but in terms of this weird feeling
Absolutely.
Now this makes sense to me. Now
the biggest fire ever in the history of the world was taking place on the other side of the world. And it just, I mean, this is the wonderful thing about nonfiction is sometimes the thing that seems like a problem, like this never got covered, I don't get it, turns out to be, it has a logic that when you do the reporting and you see it suddenly, I mean, that
it's
was...
It's just such a simple explanation.
Yeah.
Like, and this is huge, but something huge happened.
And what was funny is, I had forgotten this, but the entire front section of the New York Times was devoted to Chernobyl, literally. Like page after page was Chernobyl. And I think it's easy for us to forget how terrifying it was mysterious at the time, where they were scrambling, trying to get information. So it was, I mean, this is partly why I love writing nonfiction, is it's really nice to solve a mystery like that. Why was this fire somehow ignored, so overlooked?
Yeah, it's incredibly satisfying, I think, that story, but also the things that one does turn up when one is investigating a subject, the coincidences, and we're talking about timelines, and you can never believe that this happened round about the same time as that. I mean, I was telling Susan earlier, one of my favorite facts is that the Victorian novelist Thomas Hardy drove himself in a car to see an adaptation of one of his books into movies. And you think, that is not possible. But he died in 1920. He was a very enthusiastic motorist right from the beginning. He didn't write a novel after 1899, but one of the first films ever made was a version of Tess of the D'Urbervilles. But that kind of, you know, the primitiveness of Hardy and his worldview running up against the modern world, you think that actually can't have happened, but this is a thing that nonfiction writers find out all the time. This is from the great biography of Hardy by our own Claire Tomalin in England, who's a wonderful biographer.
It is fascinating, and you just uncover stuff that we otherwise wouldn't think about, which leads me to this project that the two of you were working on, Rin Tin Tin. I watched that program when I was a kid. You made it personal because you wanted this figurine of a German shepherd. You wanted to play with it that your grandfather had. And then you give us this history, and you've got these characters. And I thought it was very, very complicated. That was a very complicated story. So Nick, as a filmmaker, what attracted you to this very complex story to try to pull this down into a movie?
You know, I think sometimes you just let, with my adaptation head on, there are just things that you love so much that if someone says, are you interested in making a movie out of this or writing a script, I just say yes without thinking about whether it's possible or not. And with Rin Tin Tin, I'd read the book, adored the book, and my English film agent said, I should tell you that there's this guy called John Lyons in the US who's interested in making some film about some dog. And I told him that you were unlikely to be interested. And I said, what's the name of the dog? And she said, Rin Tin something. And I said, if that's Susan's book about Rin Tin Tin, I'm in, just like that. Because I thought, if someone wants to pay me to think about how to make that into a movie, I want to do it. And we made a very sort of straightforward decision that we would only write about the life of the first Rin Tin Tin, which was, he was found in 1918 and he died in 1930. I want to say 32.
Yeah.
So it's just that lifespan which makes the adaptation less complicated, because Susan's book is so brilliant and funny and eccentric, but it goes right up to the end of the 20th century. with people still arguing about merchandising and bloodlines and people falling out in 1988 about who owns the... You know, it's just an incredible story, but I couldn't deal with any of that in the screenplay.
So just in its essence, what's your movie? Just the life of that dog from period to this period.
The relationship between this rather odd man, Lee Duncan, who sort of behaves inexplicably a lot of the time. He was convinced that the dog was a movie star, even though he didn't know anything about movies, and even though there weren't really any movies at the time. He turned through sheer will, he turned Rin Tin Tin into this star who, as Susan points out, was the biggest male star of the 1920s. And
a four-legged one, though.
No, the biggest star, male star of the 1920s.
He made, Warner Brothers wouldn't exist today, literally, had it not been for Rin Tin Tin, because in the 1920s, he made all of their money. Mm. And they began calling him the mortgage lifter, because every time they needed more money, they made another Rin Tin Tin movie. And these were silent films, just to, you know, get people in the right time frame, because some people may be thinking of the television show. Same dog, same, and that I deal with that in the book, but the portion that we are looking at in the film is about this young man who was a GI in World War I, terrified California ranch kid who ends up in, you know, the horrors of World War I and finds some abandoned puppies that actually were German war dogs, but when they brought him back, and when he became a star in Hollywood, they actually sanitized his bio because they didn't want people to know this was a German dog.
A German Shepherd.
No, right, exactly. Yeah. And so from France.
Freedom Fries.
Yes, he was a Freedom Fry.
Freedom Fries, when you weren't allowed to say French fries.
Yeah.
For real. And, you know, and that period of Hollywood is also fascinating.
Completely. And one of the things you realize is that being a dog was no disadvantage in a silent film. That if you have an expressive face and you can jump up a tree, you can actually do more than a lot of the actors could do. So no wonder he was the biggest star. Was it eight times as much? Is that what you say in the book?
He earned eight times as much
as any male star.
And also, I think, just because you had asked me about animals, and this was something interesting, because all of us here have lived in the world of film with sound. In the era of silent films, where dogs were as expressive and could perform the way a human actor could, people, I think, liked dogs as heroes more than they liked people, because people, you know, there's a guy, he's the hero in the movie, you don't really like him that much, or he reminds you of your dentist, or he's, you know, I don't like blondes, or you have all of the feelings that you have about people. But dogs have this purity that it's, oh my God, look at this beautiful dog, and look how athletic he is, and how amazing he is. And Rin Tin Tin was not the only German Shepherd star at the time. There were dozens and dozens and dozens of imitators.
It's hilarious how many there were.
In fact, the list of the names, it was like Fang and White Fang and Red Fang and Black Fang and Lightning
and
Thunder and Lady Fang, Lady Thunder. And it was a huge business in Hollywood. And it's interesting that the film industry, I don't know that there's any other portion of the film industry that was so popular that then vanished.
No.
Completely.
The moment the jazz singer came along, then the dog could no longer be the central character in the film because it couldn't talk. So then it became a pet again, and you had characters who had dogs, but that was all they were, was the dog
right,
by the side of the character.
Kick. Yeah. And just as one detail, because I can't resist, is when Lee, who had been treated as a superstar at Warner Brothers, and Rin Tin Tin ate out of a sterling silver bowl and ate steak every day and was treated like a huge star, he gets his this notice saying his contract is being canceled, where it says, you know, Mr. Duncan, of course, you know, talkies are where it's at. And of course, as you know, dogs can't talk.
I'm sure you appreciated that.
Right, just to make the point.
Yeah.
Dogs can't talk.
There's another detail I love, which I wasn't able to fit in the script, but just before Rin Tin Tin, the one who paved the way was a dog called Strongheart. And when Susan's investigating the life of Strongheart, she finds out this address in Hollywood where Strongheart lived. And so she went to see it. And it's a little house, and the owners are there. And Susan said, I'm a little bit surprised because I heard Strongheart did really well, and I would have thought the owners would have lived in this giant mansion. And the owners now said, oh, they did. This was literally the dog's house.
Wow.
And you can, this is where you learn as a reporter just to go, oh.
you live in a doghouse.
Yeah.
So Susan, what's it like working with Nick? I mean, how does this feel, having him take this book? You spent 10 years on this book, and Nick's making a movie out of it. What's that like?
I take no credit for the adaptation. I didn't work on it in any way. This was Nick 100%.
But what if he turns it into that Orchid Thief movie that looked nothing like you?
Again. Oh my God, where Meryl Streep plays the dog.
That was my first pitch, and they said, no way.
Yeah. First of all, I was thrilled beyond measure and really excited. And it's actually very comfortable for me to say, I mean, we were talking about this earlier. I worked on that book for so long, I felt very satisfied and done. I didn't aspire to adapt it. I hoped that it would end up as a movie because I think it would be really great. I'm very comfortable saying, I did my book, now let me loan you the story and you make your adaptation of it.
You gotta trust him, right?
For sure, and certainly Hollywood is filled with stories of people who were furious about the way the movie turned out from their book. Luckily, that's not happened to me.
Yeah,
Thanks.
Yeah. So where are we? We're at the casting stage now.
Yeah. This last week or so, it's gone out to a few people. I want to say I think that the way we talk about books to movies is sort of wrong, because we talk about books being turned into movies, but books are turned into nothing. You know, books stay books throughout the whole process. They will always be there on the shelf. And if the movie sucks, no one sees it. It's all over in 2 weeks. Lots of people don't even know it was a movie. And if it doesn't suck, then more people read your book. So I think authors shouldn't be so uptight about the whole process.
I agree. And there would be a number of people said to me, oh my God, I can't believe you let them do that to the Orchid Thief. Well, first of all, I love adaptation. But secondly, I said, the Orchid Thief is still the Orchid Thief. Like, it's there, nothing happened. if you prefer the book, you're in good shape because the book's still there. And you don't ever have to see the movie if you don't want to. And, you know, there have been horrible movies made of great books. There have been great movies made from mediocre books. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever confuses them. Nobody ever somehow conflates them. They exist, they're separate mediums, and they really continue to exist where they were, and you can return. I mean, nobody likes the experience of seeing a movie from a beloved book that isn't good. I'm not saying it's enjoyable, but the book is still beloved.
Sure, sure. So let me ask about a couple of things going on in the culture that affects what the two of you do. Nick, what's your take on the book banning that's going on in libraries and, I mean, in this country, it's a thing. And I don't know how it is in England, but books being taken off of shelves for a variety of reasons. What do you make of that?
It's horrifying and heartbreaking. I live in, effectively, I live in a post-Christian country. That's what England is. It's a post-Christian country. No one has any strong religious views there. I don't know any white English person who goes to church at all, apart from maybe Christmas night. A lot of the debate here is very alien to us, the evangelical stuff, I don't follow or fathom. But then the second aspect of it is what they call the culture wars, the war on woke, that we do have to a certain extent, and certainly we have conservative politicians who are trying to import your war on woke into the UK. And it's just as depressing as the evangelical stuff. And you know, it used to be called politically correct. And when I was growing up in England in the 60s and 70s, there was no such thing as politically correct, and it was horrible. You know, it was, you could see racist jokes on the BBC, you know, on the channel that the government pays for. And that was pre-woke. And everything about that stuff, woke and political correctness, seems to me to be a welcome antidote to some of the unthinking and awful anti-Semitism and racism and certainly sexism and misogyny that I was force-fed on television when I was a kid. I'm very reluctant to go back there, but that seems to be what these people are after.
Susan, what do you make of book banning here?
I think it's terrifying.
Why?
I think nothing good ever comes from a culture that tries to control what you read and what you know. I wrote a lot about this in the library book because obviously libraries have been burned before the LA Public Library. They've been burned since the day they were built. And it's almost a signature gesture of oppression to burn a library. There's no military value in doing so, and yet it's done over and over again. In war, the Nazis had a squad of commandos who had one mission, which was find libraries and burn them. And there's a reason, and the reason is to oppress a culture, wipe out a sense of collective memory, make people feel unsafe.
I mean, it would scare me
to see. I mean, there's something really visceral about seeing people burning books, which is usually when you're gonna, I mean, it's been done in this country a lot. I mean, there have been all sorts of book bannings that are celebrated exactly as the Nazis did by making a bonfire of the books. And I think there's something deeply disturbing about
it. It's incredibly sinister.
But we don't burn them physically as much as we used to.
Right.
We cancel them.
Right.
But is it the same thing?
Well, yes, absolutely. And I think to tell a library that they can no longer offer book X or book Y or book Z, I think there is never a healthy society that says we are going to control what you learn. I mean, it's interesting because my parents never said we could see this movie but not that one, or read this book but not that one. Kids are incredibly savvy. They tend to gravitate to what they want to see and not the stuff that really isn't appropriate for them. Or they may peek at it and then move on if it's not really for them. So the idea that you're protecting children, I mean, I just can't state it strongly enough. I think it's wrong. I think more than wrong, it's frightening to think that someone is going to tell me what I can read. That's like saying, I'm going to tell you what you can think. Because reading is just a way of me taking what is in my head, what I'm thinking, and sharing it with you. And someone is getting in between us and saying, you can't think it and you can't hear what she's thinking. There is no excuse ever for that.
I was asked to write a little bit about The Kite Runner, which is also being banned in American schools, some American states. And the problem with that book, from the censor's point of view, is that it features the rape of a young-ish boy. Male rape of a youngish boy. It's horrific. But to read that and say, I don't want my children to read this, the book is about how no one's child should experience that. It's the central event in the entire book. No one takes it lightly. It destroys the narrator for complicated reasons. And to just take that incident out and say we mustn't see that means that you can never understand what other people are enduring in the world. And that makes you very stupid as a nation, I think, not to be able to see what is happening. And, you know, you can go to war with the Taliban, but if you're denying women's rights at the same time as you're banning books, you think, really? You know, you've got to make more of a distinction than that.
So, what about artificial intelligence? That's kind of a thing. What do you make of that, Susan? Do you think it's going to replace you?
It's a little scary. I did an exercise recently where I asked ChatGPT to write something in the style of Susan Orlean. And I was telling Nick about this earlier, which was, you know, it was a little scary. I wouldn't say the result was good. I would say that it picked up on all my worst habits and presented them.
That's why you have a husband.
Yeah, well, exactly. It was, will it replace me? I think it will replace a certain level of service journalism. I think it'll replace listings and the kind of stuff that was already essentially mechanized but being done by a human. Can AI go out and talk to people and learn about them and explore their lives? I don't see that happening yet.
Or come up with those descriptions that you come up
yeah,
with.
Yeah, I don't think we're there yet, but I think it's going to have a big impact on, I actually think it's going to have a bigger impact on some other industries first, before journalism. I think.
Like who? What jobs should we be avoiding?
Accountants.
Uh-oh.
A lot of law, I would have thought.
Law
lower level.
Paralegals.
Yeah, paralegals.
I think it'll really, because basically it will search and find the citations, which is really what paralegals do. So I think those jobs that involve a certain amount of tedium anyway, and going through lots of material and sort of collating information, I think those jobs will go away. I really don't yet see it coming close to interfering with writing as
creative
we know
writing,
it.
Yeah.
Okay. Nick, what's your worry level, Nick?
I wouldn't say. My 21-year-old wrote a university essay, and the thing he hates doing is the citations. I mean, it just drives him nuts. And he asked ChatGPT to do the citations for him.
Yep.
And they all came up, and he was so pleased. And he looked, and he thought, oh, I don't think that's mentioned in the actual essay. And and they were all rubbish. They looked like citations. They were exactly like citations. And in the end, he said to ChatGPT, basically, are these rubbish? And ChatGPT said, yes, they are all rubbish. Yes. So that looks like it's going to be a while. I think in terms of, I think it's perfectly possible that in 100 years' time, artificial intelligence will be able to do everything that we do. I think I'm coming to the point in my life where you realize that you're not going to be around to see some of these things, and you think, I can't be bothered to give you an opinion because I'll be dead.
Yeah, that's a
nice
awesome way to look at it.
I'm gonna
try that with my kids.
Go on.
Well, you said though one time that not to lament new technology. Writers will have to stop being self-indulgent and boring if they are to attract any attention.
Mm.
And so you've been pretty open with new technology is not necessarily something to be feared, but you got to engage, right?
Completely. And I do think, for example, I think a lot of literary fiction has really painted itself into a corner. It stopped engaging with the way people consume things. It's not visual or cinematic in a way that I think a lot of people want. It's not very funny. People don't make jokes very often in prize-winning novels, and people have stopped reading them and listening to them, but it's not the same thing as saying that there's no good writing going on. There's a lot of good writing going on, but I think you've got to take account of what's going on around you and see what is connecting and why it's connecting, rather than just pretending that this stuff is always connected, therefore I'm going to plod on with it.
Right. So we're at the end of our time, and I'd like for you to give us, the aspiring writers in the group, some advice. They're slugging away. What do you want to tell them? Susan, let's start with you.
Susan first, yeah.
Well, I would say pay for the pro level of ChatGPT.
Yeah,
the
free
better.
Yeah, the free one is rubbish, right?
I'm maybe a Pollyanna, but I think and I believe deeply in story and storytelling. I don't think that will ever go away. The better you are as a storyteller, the more valuable you will be, whatever form it takes, whether all magazines go online. Look, the world of publishing has changed since the day I started writing. It's always changing. It's probably changed technologically more than many professions. But what never has changed is a good story is a good story. I think that the advice I would give to aspiring writers is your story ideas are your currency. Developing the curiosity and the capacity to think of good story ideas, to follow good story ideas, to understand what makes a good story, that's what's going to get you jobs. That's what's going to get you a book contract. Whatever changes happen in the profession, and they'll keep it'll keep happening. It won't end at, you know, AI. There will be more and more iterations constantly, but stories never change. A good story remains a constant and always will, and learning how to recognize that and pursue that is your insurance.
That's wonderful advice. Nick, what have you got for us?
Well, I think the first thing I would say to any writing student is, are you reading? Are you reading everything that you can get your hands on? There's a terrible tendency, I think, not among these students that I've met today.
Of course not.
But everyone wants to be a writer and no one wants to read. Apparently with poetry, that's absolutely true. That there are way more poets than there are readers of poetry books or poetry magazines. No one's very interested in anyone else's poetry, but they want you to read theirs. And it's an interesting thing about writing is that one of the processes of growing up, all of us, is understanding and accepting that we're not special. And you know, you might think that you want to be Meryl Streep or you want to be Roger Federer or you want to be Lionel Messi. And very slowly, as you get older, you think, oh, I'm actually only the seventh best footballer in my class at school. And the best one isn't getting anywhere near the Argentina national team. So these things start to fall away. And the one thing that never falls away is writing. Everyone thinks they can write because they can. Like, if you're literate, you can write. And there are so many different kinds of books. We all know if we go into a bookstore, we're looking at books on those shelves, and you're thinking to yourself, that person cannot write for shit. And their books are everywhere. That person's a genius. Right next to the person who can't write for shit. So it's a very difficult medium to be prescriptive about. Like, even writing well or writing badly doesn't make any difference. But if you read, first of all, you find stories. I mean, every novel you read, every work of nonfiction you read contains three or four other stories that you can lift straight out. And I don't mean that about plagiarism, I just mean that the way this character is talking to that character about that subject might make you think that that can be dramatized in the 21st century, even though this is a 19th century novel, and so on. There are stories everywhere. There's five movies in every episode of The New Yorker, and they sell five articles a week probably to the movies. So read. And the other thing is it's hard. There's no shortcut with agents or publishers. People say, what is the name of your agent? How do I get an agent? Well, I said, don't worry about that stuff. If you've written something brilliant, you're not going to worry about who the agents are because they'll be coming to you. So it's write every day, read every day. That's it.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.